Hi, welcome to Creeks to Peaks, The Understory, the podcast that highlights West Virginians, both near and far, who are doing amazing work in their respective fields, many of whom you may not even know about. Our goal is to bring your attention to these individuals, their stories, and how they connect to the state. In forestry terms, the understory means everything underneath the canopy, and those are exactly the people we're trying to highlight. Maybe not household names, but stars in their own right. So join us as we talk to our guests about who they are and where they come from. This podcast is produced by Flag Spruce Initiative, a West Virginia-based nonprofit whose mission is to invest in and advocate for the education, environment, and economy of West Virginia, or what we refer to as our three E's. To donate and find out more about Creeks to Peaks, The Understory, and Flag Spruce Initiative, visit www.flagspruce.org or follow us on Instagram. Hey everyone, Michael here. Welcome back to another installment of Creeks to Peaks, The Understory podcast. On this episode, we sit down with Brian Chapman. Brian is a native of Nicholas County, West Virginia, and is perhaps the first West Virginian to have summited Mount Everest. He is also a former Special Forces Colonel, having served for over 30 years. We talk with Brian about the mental and physical toll of climbing Everest and what makes someone commit to such a dangerous endeavor. We also dive deep into his illustrious career as a Green Beret. Thanks again for tuning in, and as always, take a listen. All right, Brian, welcome to Creeks to Peaks, The Understory podcast. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Michael. It's a privilege to be asked to be on. I've listened to some of your other podcasts, and I mean, it's amazing how many West Virginians have accomplished so many amazing things. Like I've Nick McCary, who's another fellow Green Beret, and then Kimberly Reed, Woody Williams. I mean, that's an amazing story, and you were lucky to have the chance to interview him. And then I listened to Lonnie and Ellen Thompson. I mean, they make me want to get out right now and go on another expedition and do something exciting because, I mean, amazing people. I'm humbled that I'm not even in the same category as these people, but thanks for asking me.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I really appreciate you coming on, and thanks for listening to the other episodes. We've been blessed with, like you said, Woody Williams. That was an amazing experience. And then Lonnie and Ellen Thompson, you know, I was able to go up to Ohio State and sit down with them at their Polar Research Center, and to be married for over 50 years and studying, you know, climate change and glaciers all over the world, and a little 5'3" West Virginia woman leading these men on Antarctic expeditions. Just, yeah,
it's incredible.
These stories are amazing. But let's get to you. Obviously, one of the big reasons I asked you to be on here is in 2010, you summited Mount Everest, the tallest mountain in the world. What even made you want to do that?
That's a good question. When I was at First Special Forces Group, I got to be on a mountaineering team. And so I also got the chance to climb on Mount Rainier and summited Mount Rainier out in Washington State a couple of times, which has got everything that Everest has except for the altitude. It's got the glaciers and the severe weather and the snow and ice, and really enjoyed the challenge of it. So it got me hungry to be climbing. And then I got to Nepal in 2007. I was posted to be the defense attaché in the embassy in Kathmandu.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I, you know, you start meeting people just walking down the street. Like I met Jomling Norgay, you know, who's the son of the first summiter of Mount Everest,
Tenzing
Norgay. Yeah. And Pete Athens, and these people that I've seen on documentaries and everything, and you're just having coffee and you go have lunch with them, and then like they're just regular Joes walking down the street, and they can climb Mount Everest. Maybe I could climb Mount Everest, because it just seems something that I've only seen in movies, I've only read about in books, and it seems otherworldly. And then I met this young lady who was a British diplomat, and she had climbed it the year before, and got to talking to her, and she's like, "Oh yeah, well, I got the climbing fee waived because as a diplomat, you know, you don't have to pay the climbing fee." And I'm like, "No way."
That's huge.
Yeah, it was $10,000.
Wow.
Off the cost. So I started researching it, and I'm like, well, it's now or never. So I, asked the Army. I said, hey, I've done a great job here for you for 3 years. What do you think about me using my 2 months of leave and climbing Mount Everest? And they said, absolutely not. So I polished my delivery a little bit, and I asked again, and I got a yes, but don't tell anyone and don't die.
That's a big ask.
So I got the yes, and then it's sort of like the dog who caught the car. I'm like, oh my gosh, I just, I'm going to go climb Mount Everest, and what do I do now? So
right.
I just circled back to my special forces training, which is throw a heavy pack on your back and walk uphill and do it for long periods of time. So I just started during the week throwing a pack on and walking on the Stairmaster in the embassy gym for a couple hours a day. And then on the weekends, there's a big mountain, just a mountain. They call them hills because the real mountains are the Himalayas, but a mountain just to the north of Kathmandu called Shivapuri. And I'm guessing it's probably 6,000 feet.
Okay.
They call those hills in Nepal. So I would throw on my pack 40 pounds of water weight every weekend. And I would get up in the morning, and my Weimaraner dog and I would go hiking up for about four and a half hours to go up to the top. And then I would take off my mountaineering boots and dump the water out and change into my running shoes, and then run an hour and a half back to the car. And so that was my weekend workouts.
That's amazing. And there's a lot to unpack there. I want to start with talking about, you mentioned you had a special forces background. When did you join the Army, one, and then how did you get into special forces?
So I joined the Army. Really, I started ROTC between my sophomore and junior year of college at West Virginia University. Went on active duty in 1990, and I was a combat engineer, and spent some time at 10th Mountain Division, and then ended up in Korea in 1993, and then commanded a company over there as a combat engineer. But I've always, wanted to be a little different and try the next hardest thing. Had been to Ranger School in the Army. And so I wanted to go to Special Forces. So I remember going, the recruiters coming to Camp Casey in Korea. And, there was a handful of people that showed up, and the recruiter looks around and he's like, I can tell just by looking at this group, who will volunteer to toe the line and who won't. And I'm like, well, I'm going to be one of the ones who, he's not talking about me because I'm going to be towing the line. So I put in my packet, went to Special Forces Assessment and Selection, which was separate from the Q course and everything back then. So that would have been in January of 1995. And I, did that 3 weeks or whatever it is, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And just, it's really interesting where you start with four buildings full of people and it whittles down to the end of the last week. And you've got one building, cleaned it.
A lot of attrition. It sounds like
a lot of attrition. I don't remember. It's sort of like 17% of the people make it that start or something, but the idea is to call out the folks that aren't really serious before that you send them to the Q course and spend a lot of money PCSing them before Bragg and all of that.
Okay.
And then so I went to my infantry officer advanced course, started rock climbing, actually started rock climbing in Korea, and then continued to rock climb with buddies around Georgia. Went to the Q course. Did fine with that. Then I got out of the Q course. When I was in language school, I went back to West Virginia and did a Seneca Rocks course for like 5 days, lead climbing, and climbed at Seneca Rocks, and just really enjoyed that aspect of climbing.
Yeah, trad climbing.
Yeah.
Doing some traditional climbing.
Totally traditional, and then doing the lead climbing. So I really, you know, got some great pictures of me, a young guy in my 20s, standing on top of Seneca Rocks.
Very cool. That's a great place to learn and practice too.
Absolutely. And then I, after I finished up my training, I went to First Special Forces Group.
Okay. Where's that located at?
That is in, Washington State, Fort Lewis, Washington. And, they've got an Asia focus. So I did a lot of deployments to, Laos and Sri Lanka and Thailand, and you know, got to do some interesting things. Back in the days before 9/11, we did a lot of foreign internal defense where we would go train other armies. Got to go to Sri Lanka and train their special forces and rangers during their civil war with the LTTE terrorist group. Really interesting when I got to go 3 months in Laos and train D-miners in how to clear all of the unexploded ordnance that's left over in their country from Vietnam War. And that was an amazing experience. And there's really a lot of unexploded ordnance still left there.
And that was when you were in first group. So did you have a little bit of a background with your combat engineer job doing any of that?
At least I understand all of the explosives and all of that kind of stuff. So I had a background in all that prior to it. But, you know, in Special Forces, it's really the non-commissioned officers who are doing the teaching and doing the execution. Then you're sort of managing the operation. So I didn't do a lot of the hands-on explosive stuff, but I could have.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Very cool. That's amazing. And so from that experience, you continue just to climb the ranks, it sounds like, because from 95 till the time you got to Nepal, what rank were you when you got to Nepal?
So when I was a lieutenant colonel when I got to Nepal. So I left first group as a senior captain.
Gotcha.
And good things, I went to teach ROTC for a year at University of Colorado Boulder.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And it was another great experience because I got selected to be on the Army's team for the Hawaiian Ironman. And you know, got to train there with greats like Dave Scott and these great legends from the triathlon world.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a great experience. And then I got promoted to major there.
Okay. Man, Boulder for, well, both triathlon training and, you know, if you're continuing to work on your climbing, that's a fantastic place to live.
Yeah. So after I did the Ironman in October of, I guess that would have been 1999. And then the rest of that winter, I just got with the Colorado Mountain Club and I climbed 14ers, you know, with snowshoes on and stuff like that. So that was just a thing to do on the weekend. It was very interesting because normally these clubs have some very strict training regimen that they want people to go through before they take them out for safety reasons.
Sure.
And I was always trying to like, hey, look, I'm a Green Beret. I was on a mountain team. I've climbed Mount Rainier a couple of times. And I always had to convince people. And there was one guy who was a really hard sell. He didn't want to let me go, but then he relented. And the irony is we get up to about 13,000 feet. The guide gets deathly ill, retching, can't carry his rucksack, totally has altitude sickness. And I have to carry his pack and help him down. You know, all the people, I'm like, this is the guy who wasn't going to let me go because I might be a danger to his expedition.
So yeah, that's funny how the tables turn. Huh. So it sounds like, you know, listening to you talk about training outside Kathmandu, and there wasn't a lot of, that was more cardio than anything, because probably not a lot of, unless you got up into the Khumbu or, you know, the Annapurna region, a lot of technical training for you at that time in Kathmandu, right? Or were there opportunities to work on rope skills and get some glacier travel and different things like that?
Yeah. So once I knew that I was going to be doing Everest, I did a couple of climbs on my own, one of them being Island Peak.
In Jiaotse. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's about 20,300 feet. And I just, you know, I would talk to say, hey, anyone know? Yeah, I know this Sherpa kid who wants it. So it would just be not the safest thing in the world in hindsight, but it would just be me and this Sherpa kid who was probably 19 years old. And we would go out and climb Island Peak together.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's very cool.
And it was. Because these are places that I had only read about in books or watched in the IMAX film, you know, of Everest. And suddenly you're just hanging out there in these places in Namche Bazaar and all of this. And so I really enjoyed trekking all around the Khumbu and everything. And I did that before the climb, just because I wanted to do it. I wanted to experience this stuff. And so I did a couple of things where you do high passes of 17,000 feet or so, which I really needed to do to prove. I went with a company called International Mountain Guides, IMG. It's run by Eric Simonson. Simonson, who's one of the guys who found Mallory's body on Everest.
George Mallory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he's a legend, you know, he's climbing forever back in the 80s and all that. And so I went with him, but I needed to prove that I could handle the altitude. He's like, look, you've done the Eco Challenge. You've done the Iron Man, but I know you're physically fit, but can you, you know, we don't know about the altitude. So that's why I decided to climb Island Peak and do a few things to make sure I could handle it.
And so you were doing those things and then reporting back to him like, hey, went out on my own with a Sherpa, went and accomplished this, just so you're in the loop on, you know, where we're at right now. And then you also had, you climbed Rainier. So there's some technical aspects to that as well. And then you were doing the Colorado Mountain Club climbing. So you definitely had a mixture of cardio and a technical experience going into it, which is awesome. And I was going to ask about, you know, the altitude part. Cause like, well, 6,000 feet, that's a far cry from even just trekking in the Khumbu. And then not even, you know, talking about getting up above 29,000 feet to where you're ultimately shooting for. That is a world of difference in terms of elevation gain. So that's awesome that you were able to make it over there. At that time, were you flying into Lukla?
Yeah.
That's an experience, isn't it?
That must be the most dangerous part of the whole Everest expedition.
Yeah, so I was able, I think we've talked about this in the past. I went and did a high altitude climbing course for, you know, a little over a month in 2010, which was right after you climbed Everest. And so I was over doing Lobache East, Island Peak, some of those. And we got back and I was watching the History Channel back in the States, you know, a little while later. And they had this program that had the top 10 most dangerous airports in the world, and Lukla was number one. And yes, I was like, oh, absolutely. Man, it doesn't surprise me. It's on the side of a mountain at like, I don't know, 9,000 feet or something. There's been multiple accidents. So that's an experience.
Yeah. You literally carved in the side of a mountain, a incline landing strip. So you land going uphill and you know, those twin otters are going downhill, like they're, and then at the end of the runway, they just kind of are in air because it's on the side of a mountain.
It's wild. I think the whole trek from Lukla to, you know, Everest Base Camp is an experience in itself. And I'll let you talk a little bit more about that. But there's no roads. You know, they get all their supplies in from basically flying it into Lukla and then yak caravanning or, you know, donkeys and Sherpas and porters, just taking it from these little Sherpa villages all the way up to as far as you can go, which is maybe Gorak Shep right beside, Everest Base Camp there. So for me, that was, you know, we're staying in tea houses that for you, I'm sure that was part of the acclimatization just to get to Everest. You're acclimatizing along the way. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was lucky because before I knew I was going to climb, I had done two other one of them being Ivan Peak and another one where you go around to the, I think it's to the east, and you go up over or past, it's this beautiful emerald blue lake, greenish blue lake. And it's not very popular because it's a little bit off the beaten path, like you're going to the Khumbu, to Everest Base Camp. But then you go over a couple of passes and you come down into the Khumbu. So I'd done a couple of treks in there, and it's just so peaceful. And you walk, and you can be in your own head, and you can do thinking, and you know you're just watching these people that live hard. I mean, I've seen people carrying, you know, a keg of beer on their forehead, you know, or a refrigerator on their backs, or the things that they get in there, or, you know, huge, you know, one by one by one, long timbers to build houses. And they carry them on their backs.
Yeah. It's amazing. It really is. You know, there's not a lot of places like that left in the world. And that place isn't necessarily getting more commercialized, but there is definitely more foot traffic over the years. Just going to climb Everest every year too. Well, speaking of which, how many people were on the mountain when you were climbing?
I don't know numbers. And okay. To be honest with you, it doesn't feel crowded mm-hmm. until the summit push.
Okay.
And then everyone's trying to get to the top at the same time.
That's probably where you see the pictures. I was looking at something recently, and it was just a traffic jam of, it seemed like 100 people in a line back to back trying to get to the summit. And I didn't know if that had been the case, when you went, or if that's more of a newer experience for climbers, or what's going on there.
I think there's potential that there's always a traffic jam.
Yeah.
It just varies in how big of a traffic jam it is.
Okay. And is that a choke point due to like the Hillary step at the top? Is that where the choke point is, or?
That is definitely a choke point, but okay. It starts about camp 3.
Okay.
And then certainly from camp 4 on, because there's really one fixed rope.
Yeah.
And you're just in a line of people.
Okay.
And as people are going up, you know, there'll be a little small, like the only time that I got a little bit cold on the summit push, and we're jumping all around, I know, there's a lot of climbing in that 53 days before you do that summit push. But I was standing, and there's just this maybe 10-foot section that's kind of some rock that's exposed, and it's not really that hard. But I stood there for 45 minutes trying to get while the five people in front of me tried to scramble up. And I think it took me like 30 seconds to get up it. I mean, there was really no reason. So I still believe there's a lot of people in that mountain that do not need to be there.
Yeah.
Which is where the danger comes.
Sure.
But that was a time where you're just standing waiting for other people. And depending on the weather conditions, you know, that's where people start getting frostbite on their fingers and toes and things like that. So other than that, I could work around people. When you get to a place called the balcony, where people normally change their oxygen bottles, and it's the first time where, you know, you sit down with a pack on and you're at high altitude, it's hard for a lot of people to get up. But I was like, my Sherpa was named Dorji Lama. I'm like, come on, Dorji, just change and keep going. So we changed our oxygen and kept going, you know, pushing it. I wanted to get up there and get ahead of all the lines of people. And as you're climbing up the south summit, one of the most beautiful things in the world is you look to the left, because the sun's rising in the east, and you look to the left of the west, and Everest just forms this perfect pyramid. You may have seen pictures of it online, but the shadow of Everest is a perfect pyramid. And you know that you're standing, you know, near the top of that pyramid. And it's my screensaver on my computer today. Got that picture that it's an amazing, amazing sight. But then that's right before you get the south summit. And I remember everyone just was stopped, and I couldn't really figure it out. And, you know, daylight's just breaking. And I look, and everyone's like bent over their ice axe or just standing, standing there. And I'm like, I think they're just droning like Ranger School. Everyone's just kind of, and so I yell, keep going. And everyone like raises their head and everyone starts playing.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So that's what reminds me of all these things, you know, these analogies of Ranger School and the, you know, but like all of us, just 1 foot in front of the other. And then the South Summit, you know, it looks like you're cresting and then you get, and then you've got the whole summit ridge that goes across towards the Hillary Step, and you realize you've got a long ways to go. And
wow.
Once you get to the Hillary Step, going up wasn't a problem. And I got there, there were only, I think there were 7 or 8 people on the summit by the time I got there. I got there at 6:30 in the morning.
Okay.
Been about a half an hour up there. And then it was the descent that was what bothered me with the crowds, because there's one rope. And you need to stay roped in, because if you fall, you fall like 2 miles down to the Khumbu Icefall. I mean, it's literally 2 miles.
Yeah.
Man. 5,000 feet. And so you have like crab claws. You have a safety rope with a carabiner, and you would clip it here, and then you would reach around the climber and you would clip it, and you would unclip this one, and you go to the next person and clip. And I had people thinking they were being helpful that would unclip my line. And I would be like, do not touch my line. You know, I need to be positive control this, because you don't want to think that you're clipped in and you're not.
And then you slip.
And then you slip. Yeah. So that was the scariest part, was working my way back towards the Hillary Step. And then I had to wait at the top of the Hillary Step, which was kind of cool, because even back then I had a satellite phone, a Thuraya. And so I was able to call my wife and tell her I just summited. And then I literally sat on Hillary Step for probably another half an hour for my turn to go down, because people were coming up. And then I went down and then did that whole going around each person all the way across, because they're all trying to get to the summit and you're coming down, and you get to go, you know, clip around one, unclip, clip around the next one, unclip.
And that has to eat up a lot of time too.
Absolutely. So can you imagine if
a storm's rolling in?
A storm. And you got all these people and you got to do that. So people are either going to be taking risks, or, you know, all kinds of bad things could happen.
Sure. The Richwood Community Development Corporation is a 501c3 nonprofit whose immediate goal is to assist in the educational and economic renaissance of Eastern Nicholas County, West Virginia. The Richwood CDC will be partnering with the West Virginia Department of Education and the Appalachian Regional Commission to create courses specializing in the preservation of Appalachian culture and heritage. To learn more about the Richwood CDC, check out their website, richwoodcommunitydevelopmentcorporation.org. I want to back up a little bit, Brian. You said at the beginning of the episode that you were able to knock $10,000 off of the cost of Everest, correct?
Correct.
That's still, you know, from the estimates I've seen, you're looking at still potentially $60,000 to climb Everest when you add up everything, or were you able to cut that cost down?
No, I was able to get it much cheaper than
okay.
So back then, they had what's called a non-guided version, which means you get to climb with a Sherpa, but you don't have your own Western guide with you.
Mm.
And that was $40,000. And then I got $10,000 off that.
Okay.
And then because I lived in Kathmandu, I didn't need the hotels and the support and all that kind of stuff. So we knocked it off. So I would say I was probably in, after buying the gear and the boots I needed and all that stuff, somewhere between $25,000 to $28,000, which not so much.
Yeah.
It's still a significant amount,
I guess, but not 70 like grand.
Like a new SUV, and I care more about that than buying a new SUV.
Sure. Was your family on board with all this pretty well?
Yeah, my wife loves to tell a story. So it was just she and I and our new 2-year-old son. He was slightly less than 2 years. But she had to fill out all these paperwork that said she agreed to this, and it was like if you know your husband dies above a certain altitude, we will respectfully put his body into a crevasse or whatever. And she's like, oh my God, I can't believe that I'm saying yes to this.
You hear the stories. I don't know if you were able to see it firsthand, but definitely bodies not necessarily littering the mountain, but there's bodies that are still left up there. Like you said, they found George Mallory. They didn't. I don't think he necessarily was left up there because of couldn't get him down. But there are people like that that are still being found from bad storms or what have you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a serious. It can be a very serious mountain. I mean, I just read Into Thin Air if anyone doubts that, or any of the other number of books
sure.
that are out there.
Yeah. What was Everest Base Camp like? Was that a pretty neat experience for you, meeting a bunch of different international climbers, or was it, you know, solely, hey, I've got a job to do and I'm here to do it?
No, it was. So we were a little bit south of the main base camp. So you had the village of 1,000 or whatever. And so one of the biggest things to do on Everest is to stay healthy. And so my expedition wanted to be removed from the group that would pass around the colds and the flu and dysentery and all those kind of things and be a little bit more secluded. So, you know, we're probably a quarter mile further down the glacier.
Okay.
But just on our team, you know, we had someone from the Czech Republic, someone from China, Canadian, several Americans, a Japanese woman, you know, just all over. And so you do feel, you know, form that team. You're climbing different because it's just you and your Sherpa doing the up and back and up and back and going through the different climbs and acclimatizing. But you still share meals together and you're in the dining tent. And, you know, in special forces or in the military, we kind of have a sick sense of humor. Always you go to these schools and, you know, who's going to quit today? And you're always joking about those kind of things. So I would come in the dining tent and I would be like, I don't know, this climbing Mount Everest stuff is really hard. I think I'm going to quit. And they would all be like, no, Brian, don't quit. I'm like, no, I don't know. It's really hard. And I was just pulling their leg. I mean, kidding around, but they didn't know how to take it at first. And then they kind of caught on that this was just my shtick. That,
you know, you got to have a sense of humor when you're doing something like that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What was the Khumbu ice ball like for you? That's probably one of the most notorious aspects of Everest.
It is. So my first foray into the ice fall, I was Phil Urschler. I don't know if you've heard that name. He was one of the founding members of IMG, one of these guys who's got 400 or 500 summits of Mount Rainier.
Wow.
One of the first Americans to climb Mount Everest. He climbed from the North Face in like 1983 or something.
Wow.
Great guy. Amazing. He was with me and me and a couple of the guys on my expedition, the very first time in the Khumbu Icefall. And he was telling me a story and he goes, well, you know how it was somebody who died on Mount McKinley. He goes, you know how he died, didn't you? And I'm like, avalanche. And he's like, no, he fell in a crevasse. I'm like, no, avalanche. And so a big slide happened. And so we had to get down behind a serac. And, you know, yeah. you get the blast of air and snow that comes over. But that was the scariest part. And that was the first time through the ice fall.
In the ice fall, correct me if I'm wrong, that's just a very vast, not long after you leave base camp, right? It's a vast ice area full of seracs and crevasses that are continually shifting due to, you know, the climate and just tectonic movement. And so you have to be very careful. And like you mentioned earlier, I think, I don't remember what year, 13, 14, 15, 16 Sherpas were killed due to Sirach falling in the ice fall. So that's got to be very eerie as you move through something like that, because you're balancing yourself over these crevasses on ladders. You're walking with crampons on over horizontal ladders, making it to the other side. That has to be surreal in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So the ice fall is at about 19,000 feet is the top of the ice fall where camp one is. And then base camp is 17,500. So about 1,500 feet over a quarter of a mile. So it's like a river. It's like a frozen river falling 1,500 feet in a quarter of a mile. And so that frozen river is breaking apart just due to gravity. And so as the glacier moves and these big, huge ice towers called Siracs that are some of the biggest houses, several are big as automobiles, you always try to go through it early in the morning when the ice is solidified, because as the day progresses and gets warmer and ice starts to get softer, that's when they start toppling over and falling and things like that. So it's notoriously the most dangerous part, and it's right at the beginning of the climb.
Wow. Once you get through that, does it feel like, all right, I'm home free at this point, or you're like, well, I've still got, 9,000 feet to go?
I think if you think too much, you would know this, that you just can't, if you think too much, you'll be paralyzed by fear. And so you just keep putting one foot in front of the other, do what you've been told to do, keep a safe eye out. There's an element of luck involved, but what you want to do is get through it as fast as you can.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's the key. Just keep moving. And don't freeze up over a ladder or because of fear of heights, but some people do.
Yeah.
You never know how you're going to react until you do it. But the biggest thing you can do is get through it fast. And then you get to the top. Yeah. And there's a little bit of sense of relief, but, you got to go back down it again or a few more times.
I was going to say that's not just one time you're going through that, correct? This is part of acclimatization, climb. So you go up to get acclimatized to a higher altitude, and then you have to come back down through it, and then you're going to do it all over again.
Yeah, multiple times.
Multiple times. Yeah.
So it's called siege climbing, where you go up and then you come back down. Then you go up and you sleep maybe at 19,000 feet, and then maybe walk up to a little bit higher than that towards camp two, and then come back down through the ice fall.
Okay.
Then you rest a day, and then you go up through the Khumbu Icefall again, past Camp 1, go up to Camp 2, and you spend a couple of nights at Camp 2 at roughly 22,000 feet or so. And maybe you go up towards the Berkshun, the big crevasse below the Lhotse face, and then you come all the way back down through the Khumbu Icefall again. And then you go a few days later, you go all the way back out to Camp 2, and then you go up the Lhotse face to Camp 3, which is about 24,000 feet, roughly 23, 24, depending how high you go up on the face. And that's the scariest part for me up to that point, because the Lhotse face is pretty steep. And you get up there and you can't really stand up straight up because it's so steep, so you have to turn your feet out like a duck because you can't like put your feet straight forward or you topple over backwards.
Yeah.
It's the first time you really feel the exposure of being up there on Mount Everest. And so you go up to the Lhotse face, and at 23,000 feet, 24,000 feet, that's where you sleep without oxygen. And that's the final high point without oxygen in the acclimatization process.
Okay.
So we were at the upper end of that, close to 24,000 feet. Not a good night's sleep at all. You're just on these tents on ledges hacked out of the side because, it's very dangerous to come out of your tent without your crampons on, because if you slip and fall, you go sliding down the Lhotse face, which people have done many times in the past. But you sleep that night, which is a tough, tough night. You really feel what altitude can do to you. And you wake up the next day to go down, and it's one of those where you've read the stories of, you know, you struggle to put on one boot and you finally get that boot on, and then you fall back in your tent, you know, for like 15 minutes to rest before you can put the other boot on.
Wow.
Because you're just exhausted from lack of oxygen and lack of sleep due to the lack of oxygen.
I was going to say, yeah, you probably didn't get a very good night's sleep, which is going to hamper your energy levels for just going down the next day.
Yeah. And so that's the stuff that, you know, you train in the military because, okay, you're tired. You didn't sleep well, but now it's time to pay attention, you know, execute the standard, you know, clip your anchor in, make sure you put your, you know, that you don't make mistakes. So that's where you switch it on and you kind of push the tiredness away, for lack of a better word, because you learned that you have to do that. Stay right. Switched on. And then you make it down the Lhotse face, back all the way down through the ice fall, and then back to base camp.
Okay.
And at that point, you're considered acclimatized. You've successfully slept at 24,000 feet without oxygen. So your body has made the extra mitochondria or red blood cells, and it's capable of climbing to the summit. So after that, you go back down and you're just waiting on a weather window.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it was about 10 days, and you're worried because you're like, am I going to lose my acclimatation? But, you know, you feel like you're at sea level, but you're still at 17,500 feet at base camp.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it feels like sea level after being up that high.
What were you doing for those 10 days? That's got to be mind-numbing at times.
Yes. So I do a lot of walking and climbing up the other peaks around base camp, you know, hiking peaks. Just
Kalapatar.
Trying to stay fit by hiking up, you know, and just passing the time more than anything. Because you only read so many ebooks or listen to audiobooks, and it gets a little tedious.
I bet. And up to that point, Island Peak was the highest elevation you'd ever been to?
Yes.
Or okay. And that was around, you said, close to 21,000 feet?
It was about 20,300.
Okay. All right. And then, so no oxygen up to 24,000 feet. But after that, you're going ahead and utilize the oxygen for the rest of that climb.
Yeah. So... Okay. On the way back up, so this would have been the summit push, we started climbing on really crappy weather because, you know, the weather forecast, you want the weather to be nice on the summit push. If the weather is crap on the way up to Camp 4, so be it, because you want the good weather. So straight up to Camp 2 from base camp on the first day, then up the Lhotse face in 50-mile-an-hour winds. Mm. So this you know, very exposed face that I was talking about, you would just hear these winds start to blow, and it would sound like a freight train coming. And you just, you know, you've got your full down suit on, and you just kind of lean your shoulder, get low to the ground, and then just wait. And that wind would come roaring down the slope and just blow you and shake you. And then it would kind of pause a little bit and you would keep going. So that's what it was like back up to Camp 3. When we got there, the wind had flattened all the tents for our expedition. But all the guides know each other, so they just called, hey, we're going to get in your tents. And so we all dove into another expedition's tents. And the, you know, I can remember that I've got some pictures where the snow is... The dome of the tent's barely sticking out. The snow is so high around the sides of the tent.
Wow.
But at that point, it's when you go on oxygen.
Okay.
On the summit push. So we slept on oxygen that night. And then the next day, the weather was still horrible. So our guides made a call to spend a second night at Camp 3. So our Sherpas had to go back to Camp 2 and pick up oxygen bottles and come back up, which was unfortunate for them because I think they were a little bit more tired than they would have been on the summit day. So we stayed an extra night in Camp 3. Then we moved up to Camp 4. Camp 4 is 26,500, I believe. And that's the best campground on the whole mountain because it's completely flat. It's like two football fields, completely flat at 26,000 feet.
Nice.
But so we hung out up there, you know, eating your last meal of ramen noodles and whatnot. And I left with my Sherpa. I said I wanted to leave for the summit at 10 p.m. So left at 10 p.m., went to get up that, you know, line of people climbing in the dark through the things I've described earlier of how the sun rises and you get to see that awesome view of the shadow of Mount Everest over the complete Himalayas. And you really realize for the first time that how much higher it is than everything else. Because when you're down looking up, it doesn't look like that much. But when you're up there looking out, it looks significantly higher.
Those Sherpas work really hard to do extra work, it sounds like, with the oxygen tanks and the fixed lines. They're an amazing group of people.
Absolutely.
I was always impressed by they're one of the only ethnic groups besides one other one, I believe, maybe in South America, who are born acclimatized to an area like that. It's just in their genes. And they're not immune to altitude sickness. You definitely have ones who outclimb their body's ability to acclimate and come down with hay pace, AMS, but they are still an amazing group of people.
No, they're the real heroes and the workhorses. And they often don't get enough credit. And unfortunately, some climbers treat them like you're just my servant for this expedition. But
that's unfortunate.
Dorji was my climbing partner. That's what he was. He wasn't my Sherpa. He was my climbing partner.
And right. So share a tent together too?
No. The Sherpas would all sleep in their tent, and I would sleep in mine. So
in a tent. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I would have been happy to, but it's just the way the expedition set everything up.
Gotcha.
But he was my climbing partner. I carried my pack. He carried his pack, you know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, you know, you hear the stories of Sherpas short roping people, basically pulling them up the mountain.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever start to feel altitude sickness creeping in at all?
It's interesting. And it's odd. I never felt it above 20,000 feet. And I only felt it every single time I would get to Camp 2, I would be exhausted and have a headache. And I mean, felt terrible. And so Camp 1 is at 19,000 feet and Camp 2 is at about 21 or 22. And it's just up this long valley called the Western Coombe, which is a great Scrabble word, everyone, if you ever want to use it. CWM, no vowels. It's a legitimate word. But when I would walk up this, a lot of times it would be very hot because the sun comes out and it radiates off the snow all around and it actually gets very warm. And I would get to Camp 2 and be absolutely dehydrated and exhausted and, you know, feel terrible. I would go straight to my tent, wouldn't eat anything, and the next day I'd be fine. And then I was never had any problems, Camp 3, 4, the summit.
That's amazing. But wow.
Every single time, it was something maybe that long, hot valley. But
yeah,
I don't know what it was.
What was the total amount of time from basically Lukla to back to Lukla or back to Kathmandu?
53 days.
Did you find yourself losing a lot of weight during those 2 months?
I don't know that I lost a lot up until the summit push, but in that 5-day push, I probably lost between 15 and 20 pounds. And you don't know because you feel like you're eating as much. You know, I was at Camp 4 wolfing down my ramen noodles and granola. So I never felt like my appetite wasn't strong, but I think your body is just working so hard at that altitude that you're dying more than you're living, as they say. I mean, they call it the death zone for a reason, where you're just deteriorating quickly.
Yeah. What about cold weather injuries? Did you see many of those, or did you happen to, you know, come away with any frostbite or anything like that?
I did not.
That's great.
I didn't witness any. I mean, you know, I went there like everybody else, worried that, you know, I spent $700 on my boots because I wasn't going to do that. My wife said, "How much are your toes worth to you?" And I said, "About $700."
Yeah.
So yeah. I got the good boots, and like I said, my feet got a little cold that one time waiting in line for people to get up a little rock exposure. But no, I mean, there are lots of respiratory stuff. People that had headaches and, you know, some altitude. I mean, we lost people because of, you know, some people just said, "Hey, this is not for me." You know, they made $70,000 decisions right there on the spot and said, "I'm not doing this."
Sure.
Or people that got severe headaches, even at base camp. And then the guides would be like, "You can't, you know, we can't let you climb any higher because it's too dangerous for you," things like that. So,
right.
We were supposed to climb Lobuche Peak in the very beginning. That was going to be an acclimatization climb to save a trip through the ice fall. And at that point I woke up that morning, we were going to climb that peak, and did not feel good, like flu, upset stomach. And I said, "Hey, I can't climb." And there were like four of us in a group that were sick.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Urschler, one of the guides, said, "Here's what I recommend. Go down to Farrachet and spend 2 days. Get down lower because you either pay now or pay later. If you go up back up to base camp and you force it." So I was, you know, I didn't want to retreat, but I listened to him. I'm like, this guy's a climber who's been guiding for years. And so I went down, I spent 2 days, and I went back up to base camp, and I was fine after that. So that was very good advice, and I'm glad that I followed it.
Yeah, it sounds like you've had, or during that trip, you had a really good experience. I've learned it can go sideways quickly, but it seems like everything was pretty straightforward for you and your group for the most part, which is, it's a blessing. That's all you could ask for.
No, absolutely. Because in subsequent years, many bad things happen. And I think this year in particular was a pretty deadly year on Everest.
Have you done any climbing since then? Any big mountains?
I have not. I came back and I got deployed to Iraq shortly after that. Within a few months, I was in Iraq. And one of my goals is McKinley.
Okay.
But now I've got three very active children that are involved in activities and working, you know, retired from the Army and now working a full-time job. So I don't know how to fit it in right now. So,
yeah.
But that's one of my goals. I still would like to do McKinley.
And if you hit that one, because that's one of the seven summits, do you think you're going to try to push for the other five?
I don't think so.
No.
I would like to do it simply because I would like to do it, and I would like to do Kilimanjaro.
I was thinking about this earlier, and I think I wrote this down to ask you when I sent you some questions, but I don't know if you know this or not. Are you the first West Virginian to ever summit Mount Everest?
I don't actually know the answer to that. I suspect I am, but I don't really know.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a way to find that out.
I don't know. I mean, I guess you could probably Google it, but I don't know.
For now, we're going to call you the first West Virginian to summit Everest until someone corrects us.
That's right.
That's really cool.
And hopefully enough people listen to your podcast that they'll correct us.
I hope so. That'd be a blessing for us. You know, and I came across you because, you know, I had aspirations of climbing Everest one day, and I still do, after being over there and being in Nepal a few different times, and climbing over there. And I was just did a Google search, and somehow I missed where you had done that in 2010. I was like, well, there goes my dream of being the first guy from West Virginia to summit Everest. Maybe I'll be the second.
I'm really sorry that I did that to you.
Thanks for taking that away.
Had I known, I would have canceled my trip.
That is really cool. And it's so funny that we were over there the same year, because I was over there in November 2010, right after you did your expedition. That's funny how much of a coincidence that is. And I do love Nepal so much. You know, I feel like beautiful. I can talk about it a decent amount. I didn't live there for multiple years like you, but I've been, you know, fortunate to go there a few different times and come through Western China into Tibet and come down across the Tibetan border and ride on top of a Nepalese bus for 4 hours down these gorges with no guardrails and a 1,000-foot drop into Kathmandu and into a Maoist revolution at the time, I believe. This was 2009, the first time I went there in like May or June, and there was like we couldn't even get into the heart of the city because the Maoists were having an uprising. Really cool experiences, and I'm so happy to talk to you about it and get your thoughts and experiences of living over there. That's really cool.
Well, hopefully you noticed when you were riding on the top of that bus and you looked around the sharp curves that there were buses down at the bottom of those 1,000-foot ravine.
Oh yeah, and it's funny because it's probably at least once a year I'll see a New York Times or a Washington Post article where you know, there's a blurb about a Nepalese bus that careened off the side of one of those roads, and I was like, man, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of buses each day that don't, but it only takes one bus to that you're riding on top of to go over the side.
Yeah, it's like every 100 flights or so that land at Lukla, one of them crashes with a bunch of tourists.
Yeah. You're rolling the dice. I think we waited for 4 or 5 days in Kathmandu just to get a weather opening to fly into Lukla. So we would go to the airport and wait, and they'd be like, nope, not today. And then we go back to our hostel and hang out and go to the bars. And funny story, I always tell this story to people about the song Country Roads as well and how well West Virginians travel. On that trip, we had missed a flight because of the weather, and we went to a karaoke bar down in the I can't think of the name of the area at the moment. And somebody, a Nepalese woman, was singing Country Roads, and I was like, oh, I was talking to my climbing mates, and it's like, this is our song right here. And a guy at the table next to us, he's like, I love this song. I'm from Fairmont, West Virginia, so I know this well. I was like, what? And I was like, I just graduated from West Virginia University. So it's That's a small great. World. Yeah.
Absolutely.
He had a buddy who went to Fairmont State University with him, who was from Kathmandu. So he went over there to visit him and just happened to be at the next table while Country Roads was going on. So it's a small world.
Yeah, Country Roads is ubiquitous around the world.
It is. Yeah, it is.
If you're looking for outdoor gear for your next big adventure or for your holiday gifts, check out the iconic Waterstone Outdoors Gear Shop. Located in Fayetteville, West Virginia, Waterstone Outdoors has been serving the outdoor community for the past 30 years and has a nationwide reputation for being the destination gear store when climbing, hiking, and just all around adventuring in the New River Gorge National Park. To see just what they have to offer, check out their website, waterstoneoutdoors.com, or visit them in person in downtown Fayetteville at 101 East Wiseman Avenue. Now let's get back to the podcast.
Let's talk about West Virginia a little bit. You grew up in Craigsville in Nicholas County, West Virginia, and graduated from Richwood High School.
Yes.
In the 80s, right? In the 80s, yeah.
1984, graduated.
Did you get into the outdoors a lot in West Virginia? And did that have any influence on, you know, your experiences in the outdoors the rest of your life?
That's a good question. I did not get into like what I would call the sport side of the outdoors, mountain biking or climbing or all that. But I grew up hunting and fishing, and okay. I grew up running around my grandfather's farm in Craigsville. So I had an idyllic upbringing where I had both sets of grandparents in the same town, Craigsville, my parents, aunts and uncles, my grandparents just up the road about a mile. I had a 62-acre farm. And so I grew up working on my grandfather's farm. You know, you plant potatoes in the fall. You put up hay and split locust posts and build fences all summer long. And then you put up hay twice in the summer. And then you dig the potatoes in the fall. And then you butcher the pork at Thanksgiving. And then you butcher the beef in January. And, you know, the cycle of things, doing hard work, work ethic that came from that, I think is what drove me into doing things that everyone's not willing to do in the Army or in life. I grew up hunting and fishing like everybody does in West Virginia, but I always wanted to do it differently than everyone. So when it came to fishing, everyone would, you know, put Velveeta cheese or salmon eggs and fish for trout. And I tied my own flies and learned to fly fish. One grandfather taught me how to fly fish. And so that I was a fly fisherman in high school. And everyone would go deer hunting with a rifle. And I decided to bow hunt. And then when I decided a compound bow was too easy, I used a recurve bow and hunted, you know, with no sights and instinctive shooting, and got to where I could shoot balls out of the air with my recurve. So I got into hunting and fishing and all that when I was young. Once I got in the Army, I got away from both. And I'm just now teaching my kids to fly fish. So that's exciting, but I haven't hunted in years.
I would say, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I bet some of those, like you said, those traits that you grew up with, the hard work, the hunting, fishing, just the, I don't know, pioneer spirit in a way, if you want to call it that. It seems like that would definitely go well for a special forces soldier, or someone in the Army in general. But somebody, a Green Beret, seems like they would have those traits like that.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with the hard work ethic, and you know, just doing that, not really knowing. I thought that was just life. Once I got to high school, you know, I was kind of a late developer. So I remember I was a freshman in high school. I was only 5 foot tall. And so I wasn't the big football player and all that stuff. And I didn't really grow to my junior year. So I didn't play football and all that stuff in high school. I ran track. I played basketball, which was a waste of my time. In hindsight, I would have been a great wrestler, but I didn't wrestle. But I kind of like, you develop that confidence and everything during college at West Virginia University. Went to ROTC, started being very successful in that. And then I joined the rugby club and loved it. Loved playing rugby on WV rugby. So I spent probably 3 years playing rugby, and then played rugby in the college. And that just, you know, that's a tough, rugged, physical sport. So that was a big part of developing self-confidence, and that I think leads into all the other accomplishments.
Yeah, very cool. Do you think, growing up as a child in Nicholas County, do you think you would ever picture yourself working at an embassy in Kathmandu? Or do you think your family would have pictured that for you?
No. No, not in a million years. Like, I didn't even know I was going to join the Army. I kind of spent the first couple of years at WVU doing things that 18 and 19-year-old boys don't need to be doing, or, you know, when they don't have any adult supervision, and really knew, like, hey, I came from these salt of the earth, hardworking roots, and I'm here doing this. This is not right. I'm wasting money. I'm not being responsible. And so I had a fraternity brother who's like, well, why don't you just go to ROTC summer camp this summer? Like, they'll pay you $800. You spend 6 weeks at Fort Knox, or 8 weeks at Fort Knox, Kentucky. They'll pay you $800 and then no commitment. You come back, you either join or don't join. I'm like, really? The Army? He's like explaining to me, he's like, yeah. And then you would go in as a second lieutenant and you would have rank. And I, like, this was all new to me. I'm like, okay. So I went down to the ROTC department the next day in Stansberry Hall, you know, signed to go to camp and went to Fort Knox, Kentucky. And that was the first time I had ever flown on a commercial aircraft. It was from, you know, Charleston, West Virginia to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and went through that and, you know, just loved it. It was like basic training without, you know, as much yelling.
Yeah.
You were just a college cadet. And anyway, I came back and signed up for my final 2 years of ROTC, and the rest is history. Here I am.
How many years did you serve in the Army?
33 years.
33. That's I'm trying to think of, you hear a lot of people getting out at 20. 33 years is a heck of a career. That's so you finished as a colonel?
Yes.
Very impressive. That's amazing. Probably one of the most accomplished people to come out of your Richwood High School class, I would imagine.
Maybe, but I'm still mostly proud of still holding some of the track relay records.
Oh, really?
Our high school doesn't exist anymore. It flooded in, I think, 2016 or 17, and they tore it down. And there's been a lot of
that. Yeah.
Yeah. There's been a lot of back and forth about, they were not going to rebuild it in the city, which is sad because that would kind of be the death of Richwood. This beautiful, the city Mary on the banks of the Cherry, as the alma mater goes. But I think I read an article that it's been all worked out and the courts or the state got involved and they may be building the high school back, which
really,
I mean, the high school in those communities is the center of the community.
Yeah. I hope they do build that back. Like you said, that is a pillar of the community. And for a town like Richwood, I just got off the phone with Kylan a little bit ago and we were going over some questions to talk about, that I may have missed, when I sent you a list, and one of them that always he and I talk about is the potential of Richwood. And I wanted to make sure I brought that up in this conversation because that is a town. It's like the gateway to the Cranberry, and it's got the Cherry River running through it. It's amazing. And it could become this, I don't know, little outdoor getaway, artisan town, eclectic area, because you're not probably going to have a 4-lane highway that goes through there, but you don't have to. You could still utilize that that area in that town as a, I don't know, it's just as a unique fly fishing, hunting, mountain biking, kayaking. I've whitewater rafted down the Cherry at high levels.
Yeah.
You know, that could be an amazing
place. It's beautiful, and it's a cool, it's got the high sidewalks. It's such a cool downtown. And my mom and dad were pillars there for decades. When my mom died in 2016 and her funeral was there, that, I mean, there were probably 2,000 people that showed up for over 2.5 hours. The line was stretched around the block of people coming into her wake. And it's just a beautiful town. They had the Feast of the Ramson. I don't even know if they do that. My parents ran that every year.
Really?
A big, huge ramp feed there in Richwood. But it's got a lot of potential. But they need a visionary. And I don't even know if you would consider interviewing, but you may want to look up Jeremy Rose, who has, bless his heart, he has been trying to breathe life into Richwood for decades. I mean, he became the mayor like probably in his early 20s, and he was always trying to do things. And he's still there. I heard that he has a coffee shop now on Main Street called Cherry River Roasters. He's just trying. He's artistic, and he wants these things to come. And it's almost like he's pushing a noodle uphill because it's the people that are surrounding him, but he needs to figure out how to bring some excitement in. But
yeah,
he is tireless. He never gives up.
you know, besides Richwood, what are your thoughts on West Virginia tourism and outdoor industry these days anyway? I don't know if you were able to get back to that area much and get out in the outdoors, but do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think West Virginia needs to be known for something besides just strip mining and poor incest jokes.
Fair, yeah.
You know, I ran the New a couple of times when I was in high school. I ran the Golly a couple of times when I was in high school, and then never did much back there since. I was ecstatic when it got named, the New River Gorge got named a national park.
Yeah.
I think West Virginia, it's never going to be Colorado, but it could be the Colorado of the East, at least. You know, you got DC and all this stuff, but you need somehow to bring people in, but it can never be the end all be all. West Virginia needs some other kind of stimulus and some other kind of economy besides coal. Sure. And sure. Besides just the outdoors.
Well, I think you look at a place like, like Asheville, North Carolina. It's not, tourism isn't the main draw there necessarily. There are other industries that exist, and you could do that in maybe like the Beckley area, Princeton area, and then the outdoor tourism industry supplements that. And so people who live there also play there. And then the tourism, that brings in a whole different crowd as well. But I think you could bring in some industries and then have that outdoor recreation area supplement that. And then you are able to get a little bit more diversification with that. But Asheville is a good example. I'm sure I can name a lot of others as well. And you're right, it's probably not going to be a Colorado. You know, we don't have a big city like Denver. We don't have a Colorado Springs that has an Air Force Academy, a Space Force base, and an Army base.
No, absolutely. And I mean, you haven't asked me the question yet, but how I would finish the question of, dear West Virginia, would be demand more from your political leaders. And why I say that is I think we have had decades of political leaders in West Virginia that are kind of beholden to the few remaining powerful coal barons or the coal industry. And they, in my opinion, they lie to the voters by saying coal's coming back. We're going to make coal. Or if it wasn't for that other political party, coal's been dying in West Virginia for a long time. And coal has it's part of our history. My grandfather was a coal miner. My uncles were coal miners. My dad was a TV cable guy who sold cable to the coal miners. So I understand it's part of our roots and it always should be. And it should be held up and, as an important part of history, but it's not the future. Until we get leaders with a vision that quit telling people coal is coming back and start having a vision for the future. And I once was at in India when I was working in the embassy there, the governor of Virginia was there, selling Virginia to the Indians. And I was having a glass of wine with the governor of Virginia and we were chatting at this reception and I told him I was from West Virginia. And he said, we have coal, but I know that coal is not the future and it's not going to be the future. So we got to look at other things. And that was the first time I had that thought of, he's right. You can't keep telling people we'll do everything we can to bring coal back because it's not the future, it's the past. And we need leaders in West Virginia that are going to be looking for the future, not the past. I want to add on to that, part of Dear West Virginia. The second thing I would say to West Virginia is don't be afraid to venture out. I know most of your podcasts are people that have left West Virginia, like myself, but the confidence that we gain living and growing up in West Virginia, that common sense, that work ethic, that down to earth, I can do anything, I can overcome, you know, I get a flat tire in my car, I can change it, I can fix this or do that. All of that stuff translates into the real world. Don't be afraid to try big things. Don't ever let anyone tell you you can't do it because you're just from West Virginia.
Nice. Okay. Brian, we like to do a lightning round near the end of our episode. So I'm going to ask you a few questions and then you just answer in a quick response. So what is your favorite West Virginia outdoor recreation spot?
Probably the Gauley River.
Okay.
You know, I had my most fun running down the Gauley River in the fall when they let the water out of the dam.
Right now, it's going on, at least for another week. And then it'll be Bridge Day and then it'll be over. Me too. I love the Gauley. Love the Gauley. All right. What about who's your favorite West Virginia celebrity?
Probably Don Knotts, because I grew up when Mayberry was still a big thing, and there was a street on the way up the hill to Belmar Avenue where my fraternity house was that was Knotts Street, so I remember that. So
okay,
Don Knotts, gotta love Barney Fife.
Nice. Favorite West Virginia festival?
The Cherry River Festival in Richwood, West Virginia.
They still have it?
I hope.
Me too.
But that was the highlight of the summer every year was the Cherry River Festival.
Very cool. And finally, favorite West Virginia tradition?
Wow, that's a stumper. I would say I have many, but they're all based on my family, so they're not really West Virginia. For Christmas, we would all go to my aunt's house for Christmas Eve dinner. Christmas Day, we would go to my other aunt's house for dinner. Every Easter would be at my grandmother's. And every Thanksgiving would be at my parents' house. And when I say this, like 40 people from the extended families would show up at each of these things. So those are my favorite traditions to look back on, of how the whole family would come together, break bread together, and be a great, big, huge extended family.
Very cool. I think that's a huge part of West Virginia in general. So I'm sure a lot of families have those traditions that are special to them and specific to them. So I think that was a great response. And with that, I'd like to thank you for coming on the program.
Yeah, thank you. I am honored.
This has been great.
I don't deserve to carry the water of some of those people that you've had on here, but thanks for inviting me.
You're doing an awesome job.
Thank you for joining us on Creeks to Peaks, The Understory, the podcast that highlights West Virginians, both near and far. If you enjoyed the podcast, want to hear other West Virginia success stories, or would like to donate to other Flag Spruce Initiative projects, please visit www.flagspruce.org. Also, feel free to reach out to us on Instagram. We'd love to hear any recommendations you have on other people that you might consider part of West Virginia's understory. Thanks, and have a good one.